Noriko, making other daughters look bad since 1949. This is Late Spring.
Hey, Jackie.
Hi.
Welcome to Seen and Heard. This is the podcast where two entertainment assistants go through the sight and sound top 100 greatest films of all time list. Mm-hmm. Today, we're at number 15 on the list because we do ping pong back and forth between the top and the bottom. We're at number 15. This is from 1949, Yasujirō Ozu's Late Spring.
So good. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. So what have you been watching this last week, Jackie?
Why don't you go first?
Okay, so I saw The Girl Can't Help It, the Jane Mansfield film.
I've always wanted to see
it. It was fun. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's kind of this jukebox musical type movie where they bring in all these acts from the times, like Little Richard's in it, Fats Domino and the Platters, and the movie's just mostly kind of runs off these
performances. That sounds right up your alley.
But it has a beautiful look to it. It's just shot beautiful. It looks like candy. Mm. Like the color palette of this movie, a lot of blues and reds and stuff. So fun. It was a good time. Also, I saw for the film club A Foreign Affair, the Billy Wilder movie with Marlena Dietrich and Jean Arthur, which
was
great.
It?
Yeah. Which was so good. It's funny because I hadn't heard of it prior to doing it for the film club, even though I'm a big Billy Wilder fan, and I was surprised just how great it is. Like, what a consistent director. Like, Billy Wilder has never let me down.
Yeah. Except there's one movie that he let me down.
What?
Love in the Afternoon.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Oh my God.
No good?
It's awful.
Awful. Shit.
Well, I think I've talked about this on the podcast. Audrey Hepburn plays Gary Cooper's love interest. Oh, right.
But besides that.
And it's gross.
Right, right.
Honestly, that's the whole movie, so.
I also saw two Steven Soderbergh movies I hadn't seen before. I saw King of the Hill. Have you seen that one?
Uh-uh.
Not to be confused with the animated series. It's about this kid it's autobiographical, the guy who wrote the book. This kid in the Depression growing up kind of without his parents. His dad's a salesman and he's away and his mom is like institutionalized. And his brother is sent away. So he's just kind of left in this hotel to like fend for himself. It was pretty good. I also saw Out of Sight for the first time. I think I'd seen most of this movie before, but I'd never like properly sat down and like watched it in one go with George Clooney and J-Lo. And it's pretty good. I'm like not a huge Steven Soderbergh fan. Like I appreciate kind of like what he brings to the cinematic landscape. And I like that he's such a like student of cinema. Like, I don't know if you remember like 10 years ago, he uploaded Raiders of the Lost Ark on his website. And it was in black and white. And he took out like all the sound or something. And he just put like Nine Inch Nails in the background because just wanted you to focus on how great of a visual storyteller Steven Spielberg
was.
So he does like cool stuff like that. I like his Ocean's movies a little more than this, I think, because Out of Sight definitely has this like cool, sexy, poppy feel to it. But I think he got it more right with the Ocean's 11 movies, which I actually really like a lot. And then, last but not least, I saw a documentary called Forbidden Love, The Unashamed Stories of Lesbian Lives. This was great. So this is a Canadian documentary from about 30 years ago. And it has to do with they interview maybe 10 different women who came of age sort of in the 40s and 50s, even through the 1960s. And it's sort of about coming out and being a lesbian during that time, like in New York and in Canada and stuff, where to go, where they went, what bars they went to. And also it's sort of about lesbian pulp novels from the time.
Ooh.
And really, really fascinating documentary that's really well done.
What's it called?
It's called Forbidden Love, The Unashamed Stories of Lesbian Lives.
That sounds really cool.
It's really good. It's probably the best thing I saw in this last week. So yeah, that was my week. What about you?
Greg, how many movies do you watch a day?
I try to watch one a day.
That's more than one a day since the last time we saw each other.
Okay, so those two Steven Soderbergh movies were in one day. And then I watched three movies in one day.
Yeah, liar. I knew it.
Okay. Anyway.
You're crazy.
Hey, if I can, then I have to, you know?
What about other things you have to do?
Like what?
Write.
Well, it's the inspiration's coming from all these, you know?
Okay, yeah, sure. Well, I actually tried to write a lot this past weekend, so I didn't watch that much stuff.
That's okay.
I've also been watching Stranger Things, so that's
I'll forgive you this one time.
Yeah, Stranger Things is like, I finished the new season, and it's like, it's on its way down.
That's not what I hear from everybody else.
Really? I liked this season, but really, I only liked it because of one storyline of like 12 really convoluted, kind of random ones. Like, there was no payoff for a lot of these storylines. And not in a way that it's like leading up to next season. It's like last episode came around and a lot of things were just not even addressed.
Hmm.
And then...
Well, they're doing one more season, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I only saw the first season.
I like it. It's like a fun summer thing.
Yeah, it's fine. The way it struck me was it's all pastiche. It's all just like, hey, remember this? Remember this?
It
doesn't really have like a soul of its own. Is what, again, I only saw the first season.
I think first season has a soul. I think second season has a soul. I think first two seasons are great, but yeah, kind of just fell off.
Yeah, I didn't stop watching it because I was like, this is enough. I just like fell off.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
No, and it's just, it's interesting because like these kids have grown up now, but they're still playing kids. And I guess it mostly works, but also like you see them in real life and they're so much older than they are. And it's mm-hmm. just interesting.
Because at that age, you age, so even in like 6 months time, you're way older looking.
Yeah, exactly.
Plus those kids like, I feel like that Finn Wolfhard kid was in the new Ghostbusters.
He's in It, right?
And he was in It.
So he's in like already, he's like this 80s.
Yeah.
He's a fake 80s child.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
So interesting.
He's some kid that was born in like 2005 or something or later.
And he's so associated with the 80s.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
I know.
That sounds cool.
Sure. I'm happy for him.
No, that's cool.
I like the It movies quite a bit. You haven't seen it though, right? Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
You know, you should. Honestly, from the way that you're talking about Stranger Things, it can't be scarier than Stranger Things.
I guess. That's another reason I watch Stranger Things is because I need to keep some like suspense in my life.
Right. You should watch It because It was like Stranger Things in so many ways. I liked the new movies. I think the general consensus was everybody liked the first one, and then people hated the second one. I thought it was still good.
Are you talking about the new ones or the old ones?
No, not the Tim Curry one. I'm talking about the new ones.
Oh, the old one, there's only one.
There's only one movie, and then the new movies.
There's two,
yeah,
right?
They broke the story up into two movies, which needed, because the book is like a brick. It's huge.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I liked the second one, and the pedigree in it. Like, again, it's like Bill Hader, Jessica Chastain, Peter Bogdanovich makes a cameo in the second
one
as himself.
What?
And I think there's a joke about his ascot too.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I like it. I like both movies. I think here's the key. If you're down for like a scene where they're at a Chinese restaurant and like all the Chinese food starts coming to life and like trying to eat, like bite them and stuff, if you're like down with that idea, then you'll be down with that.
I would, yeah, I'm not scared of that.
Like, I like ridiculous things.
I just
People
don't
seem to
like
be turned off by
scary
it.
Things in the dark like popping out at you.
Oh, there's some of that.
I know.
Bill Skarsgård is really
scary.
He's terrifying as Pennywise, yeah.
There's another thing with this season of Stranger Things. Like, I was scared of the villain the first episode, but then they just kept doing the same thing. Every single episode had the same format of, like, villain attack. And I was like, okay, like, I'm now desensitized and I don't care anymore.
Right.
So that was another thing.
They made the big mistake. Anyway... Should we get into this week's movie?
Yeah, before I talk about Lea Michele again.
This is 1949's Late Spring.
Late Spring was released in Japan in 1949. It was directed by Yasujiro Ozu, co-written by Ozu and his frequent collaborator Kogo Nara, based on a short novel called Father and Daughter by Kazuo Hirotsu. Cinematography by Yuharu Atsuta. 27-year-old Noriko lives happily with her father, Professor Somiya, in post-war Japan. Their household's peaceful atmosphere is disturbed when Noriko's aunt suggests it's time she was married, leading her father to push her to try to get to know his assistant, Hattori. Unbeknownst to him, he is already engaged, and so Noriko's aunt sets her up with another eligible bachelor. Despite encouragement from her family and best friend, Noriko is persistent about her refusal to ever want to marry, preferring instead to take care of her father forever. It is only when Noriko's father tells her he plans to remarry that she accepts this unseen bachelor. However, Noriko's father was lying. And after her wedding, he comes home to an empty house and peels an apple, and the rest is film history.
It's true.
Greatest moment of all. Like, that is just everything.
And he puts his head down.
Oh my God.
Cut to the waves.
The film stars the very beloved Setsuko Hara as Noriko. This was her first of many collaborations with the director. And Chishu Ryu as Professor Somiya. And also Hariko Sugimura as Noriko's aunt. Mm-hmm. The film is the first of a trilogy of films known as the Noriko Trilogy. Three films, all starring Setsuko Hara playing a character named Noriko, different characters, but kind of the same story. It's a girl named Noriko who doesn't want to get married. We did do Tokyo Story earlier in the podcast. That's number 3 on Sight and Sound's list. And we're doing Late Spring. The only one left is Early Summer, which came out in 1951. It is not on the list. But the order of movies is Late Spring, Early Summer, Tokyo Story. The film was released during the post-war American occupation of Japan. And I didn't know this, but it was subject to the approval of censors. There basically couldn't be anything that could possibly make the Allies or America or the American occupation in Japan look bad. They had a problem with the arranged marriage of it all because they thought it was super feudalistic and it goes against individualism. There was supposed to be a scene where Noriko visits her mother's grave, but it was seen as ancestor worship. Anything that referenced the bombings had to be removed. Noriko was originally supposed to have worked for the Navy, but they had a problem with Ozu even mentioning the word Navy. It just says she had to work during the war, remember?
Yeah.
And I had no idea about this. I actually didn't. Dad says something about how Tokyo's dusty. Originally, it was supposed to be like Tokyo in ruins, but they didn't let him. And yeah, that's just a few of the things. Oh, Gary Cooper. They didn't want them to use Gary Cooper's name, but then they realized it was a good thing. They're like, yeah, sure. And so this led me to find out, you know, the shot with the Coke ad?
Yep. When they're on the bicycle.
So there's the Coke ad. There's the speed limit sign that's in English. And there's also this really cute looking cafe called Balboa Coffee and Tea. Did you see that? That literally looks like it could be like in Melrose.
Yeah.
Those were Ozu's way of like saying, yes, like America's here occupying, because they didn't let him actually say like we're living in a Tokyo that's occupied by Americans.
Really subtle, cool way to do it.
Again, incredible.
I know we talk about Hitchcock getting past the production code at the time, the Hays Code, and and slipping in a lot of sexual innuendo.
I love that. And
this is Ozu again, like expressing this in a very cool, subtle way.
Yeah. Did you know that there was censorship?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I got really into it. I read all about the occupation after
this.
This
is a couple years after the war, yeah.
Yeah, 1949. Mm-hmm. And it's always been hailed as great in Japan, this movie. It was released in the US in 1972, and yeah, pretty beloved. What are your initial thoughts?
Initial thoughts. So this was my first Ozu movie.
Me too.
I first saw this, actually it was before I moved to LA, so it's about a decade ago. And I just knew it was beloved, and so I went in blind and was kind of not fully prepared for it. I think I was young, but also I just like, maybe your first Ozu, you're never quite ready. I don't know. But the first time I saw it, I remember thinking it was kind of boring because I'm a fool.
That's fair. No.
So actually, this was only my second time seeing it. Over the course of the last decade, I've seen a handful of Ozu movies, every which one I love, like even the stuff that's not super characteristic of him, like Good Morning or something like that. But yeah, this is a truly great movie. it's not quite Tokyo Story. And for me, it's not quite An Autumn Afternoon, which might still remain my favorite Ozu. But again, those movies have a few years, especially Autumn Afternoon is made almost 15 years after this, 10 plus years after this. Tokyo Story was a couple years. But yeah, this is incredible. It's, again, I think coming off of Writer's Summer Day, which we did last week, which is such a bloated experience. It's such a tiring, it's too much and it's undisciplined. And I feel like this movie, in contrast, was such a breath of fresh air.
Oh, yeah.
Because, again, it's under 2 hours and it's a simple story told really well. And it's all about these quiet moments, these unspoken moments. And Setsuko Hara is a treasure. Oh, she's a treasure. And Chishiryu as the father is also just in everything I see him in. I mean, he's just so human.
Yeah.
And there's nothing about either of them when you're watching them where you're like, oh, they're actors. Like, they just so inhabit their roles.
Yeah.
And they're both so, like, instantly likable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, both of them kind of have this, like, half smile always on.
Yeah.
With Setsuko, it's like a full smile.
Always.
Which is funny because when she's not smiling, it's like that much more
effective.
Exactly. It's funny because in school, there was this, I had this friend named Dan and he just always smiled. Like, there are just certain people who always smile. People used to call him Smiles.
Aww.
And I remember he got in trouble one time in high school from the teacher, and the teacher's like, why are you smiling? And he's like, I just always smile. Cause that was just like permanently on his face. So these people that just like always smile. She's so great though. And I mean, yeah, they're a dream team.
They are.
Them with Ozu, come on.
Dream team.
Come on.
Dream
so yeah, team. this is a great film. If not quite my favorite Ozu, it's up there. And I think, you know, it's just a great movie. I mean, there's like not much else I can say initial thoughts wise besides just like, this is something.
Yeah, it really, really is.
How about you?
So this movie made, last episode I mentioned I'm having like major Wi-Fi problems at my house and my TV just can't connect to Wi-Fi. Just can't. So, yeah. But this made that like Wi-Fi being broken a lovely experience because I got in my bed, I snuggled up, put on this movie. I had to watch it on my laptop, like right in front of my face. And it just like cleansed me. And I just went to sleep with zero things on my mind after. Not to say that the movie's not thoughtful.
No. I know exactly
I just
what
mean,
you mean
like I slipped into such
life.
A peaceful sleep after. That it made having no Wi-Fi, having my TV not work with the Wi-Fi, a good thing.
I think all of Ozu's movies are cleansing. Yeah,
it's just cozy. I was crying though, so I had to go like
you were
freshen up a bit before I went to sleep. You know, I kind of like this more than Tokyo Story.
Oh, do you?
I think it's just because it's like
I know why you do.
Uber it's, intimate.
Yeah,
like it's just like them two, just way smaller family. I just love how much they love each other. Like, that is just, you don't see that. You don't see, like, a parental love story like that. A parent-child, like, such a pure love story with zero resentment. You don't see that. Like, that's unheard of. And I just love that that is what this is. And, yeah. It's also so full of humor.
Yes.
Like, the dad and aunt are hilarious.
The whole conversation they have about the
so
suitor's
many.
Name.
So many. The suitor's name.
Like, what are we going to call him? Because his name means,
that's
like,
one of my
bear
favorite.
Boy.
That's one of my favorites. I love when they're talking about the bride. They're gossiping about that bride at the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, if there was sashimi at your wedding, you would eat it too.
Yes.
Like, he's like, he's bashing her. And then it's just such a classic. She's trying to talk him into like talking to Noriko about his assistant, Hattori. And she goes, you should talk to her. And he goes, who? And she goes, Noriko. And he's like, about what? It's like such a, it's just funny. Like, they're such hilarious siblings.
Yeah. Because there's
Which
humor.
Another
there's humor
reason
in everyday
I love
life.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
The hairy chests. Yeah.
The hairy
so
chests.
Funny. I love, but even not even with the aunt, he is funny too. Mm. I love when she tells him, oh, you know, I spent the day with Hattori, and he goes, did you share one bike?
Yeah.
Or she says something like, I like his type, and he like puts food in his mouth really quick. There's all these beautiful, funny, like, but the humor is so naturalistic. Like, it's not forced at all. Like you said, it's not even like they're acting.
Yeah,
it's just the natural humor that comes up with like living with someone. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really great.
The change purse thing is hilarious. How he keeps telling you, like, you know, you should really return that change purse. The aunt who has, like, found this change purse that she thinks is good luck. And she's like, I'll turn it in. But it's so funny. The American censors had a problem with that, too. They're like, why wouldn't she turn it in?
Oh, God.
So annoying. It's really annoying. Also, another great thing, like, this is my last initial thought. I just love, like, film as travel. And I feel like nothing does that better than, like, Ozu and Japan.
Yeah, like when they go to Kyoto in the film.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll get into that. Yeah, I'll get into like all of that. But it was
in the beginning. Yeah, when they're on the train going into Tokyo, just how much time he takes, kind of like with their train ride and stuff. Like other movies would kind of gloss over it. It would just cut, and they'd be in Tokyo. But you get some of their train ride, and you get the dynamic too, because he's sitting and she's standing too.
Yeah. Aww.
But I love. Yeah, it's like there needs to be. I love travel again, like you said, in movies.
Yeah, but I also just meant film as travel. Like when I watch Summertime, David Lean's movie, and it's like I'm in Venice, and it's I'm watching this. I'm like, I'm in Tokyo. Like
it's one of the reasons we watch movies.
It is one of the major reasons we watch movies, and this movie does it so well.
It does. Most of Ozu's movies could be called, which is an old term from, you know, mid-century, weepies, right?
I don't know if they're weepies.
But here's the thing. Like, they are in a way.
Were you weeping?
No, I wasn't weeping. Also, I mean, I'm not, like, proud to say this, but it takes a lot for me to, like, cry in a movie. So I think this technically falls under the weepy genre, but again, it's like...
I don't think it does at all.
It's like the... No, because it's like... it's like a Sirkian, right?
Not at all.
No. Here's the thing. The subject matter is Sirkian. The execution is different. And again, I would argue classier than Sirk. But
much classier. I don't think the average person would cry during this movie.
But I think
I think a film lover would.
The material is something that Sirk would take on. And those were all weepies. And think about, again, Tokyo Story is a remake. Tokyo Story is a remake of Make Way for Tomorrow, which is like the ultimate weepy.
Yeah.
So I feel like you're in that territory, but the fact that it doesn't come off is it's like quietly devastating. And it's devastating in an everyday kind of way. Like nothing crazy happens in Ozu's films besides people just kind of aging and getting older and people moving out. Maybe someone older dies. There's no murders in an Ozu film. Like, and I think the fact that his movies are ultimately uplifting, but they're quietly devastating in this like beautiful way of just devastating in a everyday kind of way. And the fact that, like she should move out and start her own life. And I think she knows this is best for her. He definitely knows it's best for her. And it's just the circle of life. Like we all did it, you know, well, maybe not you. You know, you leave the nest and that's part of life.
And it is.
It's like one of those things where it's sad, but everybody does it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It's just such the perfect tonal tightrope balance.
Definitely. Let's talk about like this major theme of, you know, the modern world in Japan at the time.
Sure.
Versus tradition and this kind of old world that the dad and the aunt belong to. So obviously the American occupation had a big part in it. They expelled the feudal system. It was still in place before. And a new Japanese constitution was put in place. Women had the right to vote. It made discrimination based on gender illegal. So there is this real like...
A lot happened very quickly.
Yeah. And it's so interesting in this movie. I mean, all his movies kind of have this major theme of, old people versus young people. But I love it in this movie because it is just centered around her. And it's...
Well, and we get like... Because they talk about how her health is better now. They keep saying it in the movie. Like, she's doing better now. She's filled out a little more. Again, kind of referencing something that she did during the war that we don't quite get a
because he
for.
Couldn't. Yeah, yeah. Because he couldn't talk about it. Yeah. And then all these American officers were in Japan and their wives would come over and they would like hold hands in the street and kiss in the street and go dancing. And it made dating popular in Japan. And I love that there's this dichotomy in the movie. And I love how she has her friend who is like this new modern Japanese woman. Right. And she lives in this very westernized house
with her cake,
with her shortcake and her tea with milk, which is just like, what?
Wait, what?
She drinks tea with milk. She pours them tea in like saucers.
Wait, why is that crazy?
Like in Japan, they didn't drink tea with milk.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I guess so.
And they didn't use like cups and saucers.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
So it's just
I always have my tea with milk.
See, I love that about it. And then, of course, she's contrasted with the aunt who's always like in traditional garb and wants her to get married and send her off. But I love that the friend, even though the friend is this modern woman, she still wants her to get married. She still knows deep down that it would be good for her. Like, her dad is not going to be around forever. But I love that. It's not like this stereotypical modern woman of like...
Thoroughly modern Millie.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's not thoroughly modern Millie. I love how she's still encouraging her. Yes, she's saying you can just divorce him if you don't like him. But I love how real that is. It's so realistic. Like, yes, women still were getting married and encouraging their friends to get married. It wasn't this like today's woman who's not going to get married.
And there's a sense too that... Because Noriko is 27 in the movie.
Yeah.
And there's a sense that, she should have been married off by now. But the fact that the war happened when it happened and whatever she kind of went through during the war explains why she's still at home. And I think why she's more attached to her dad than like ever.
And she doesn't have a mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really sweet. And I think, that's the beauty of it. It's like she doesn't want to get married in the moment, but you leave the movie knowing that she will realize down the line that her dad did the right thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. There was a bunch of Letterboxd reviews saying like, how are people sitting here telling me like the dad made a sacrifice? No, he just sold his daughter off.
And
it's like, that's not the movie at all.
Yeah.
Like at all. He knows it's what's best for her. She, deep down, probably knows it's what's best for her. I'm not saying all women have to get married. Of course, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying her, the character Noriko, living in Japan in the 40s, like,
how could you that say he sold her thing. Off?
Yeah.
How does he benefit from this?
Yeah, exactly. He didn't want her to get out of the house.
He didn't marry her into some rich family.
Like, they're saying it's just, like, so typical of the times. It's like, you have to get married. Which is that's what people did.
Yes,
like,
absolutely. Absolutely. That's just ingrained in the culture.
Yeah.
Can I say too, just I'm jealous. Like, everything they wear in this movie looks so comfy.
So comfy.
I'm like, what have we done here? Jeans and belts and like, what have we done to ourselves?
I know.
I want to wear a robe.
I want to wear a robe too.
Actually, I did when I went to Japan. When I went to Kyoto.
Did you get a robe?
I wore I didn't buy one, but I wore one to the baths.
That's so nice.
Yeah, it was very comfortable.
That sounds lovely. Lovely, lovely.
Yeah, the whole time... It's just, there's something about the Japanese home of this time that's so cozy and comfy.
So cozy.
And everything, like comfort is always prioritized. Like, from the clothes that they're wearing to, like, the house is always so clean. And again, I know that's speaking to not just a cultural thing, but also Noriko and, like, her command of this house and stuff like that. But also, like, she gets home and her dad's like, I just drew a bath for you with warm water. And everything's about like bringing tea.
Oh my God. I was just going to say that's one of my favorite moments when he brings them a tray of tea.
Yes.
When he brings her and her friend the tray of tea.
Uh-huh.
And I think that is such a good moment. And just, it shows how much he loves her.
Yeah. It's just it's also sort of delightful and comfort forward.
What about the shortcake? That's a metaphor for marriage.
It is. That's one of the more obvious metaphors in the movie. The way she's rejecting it.
She's like, how many times do I have to say I don't want it?
And the friend's like, I made it.
Yeah.
The friend also threatens something really crazy. Like, I'm going to make you eat this. And then Noriko's like, no. She's like, calm down. I was just kidding.
Yo, why are you getting aggressive?
Like, are you going to hold her down and shove it in her mouth?
Great moment. I honestly love that moment. I love the friend. Her name is Aya. She is great.
And let's talk about her and the dad really quick.
It's cute at the end, but it's so sad. Like, she's not gonna visit. There's no way she's gonna visit.
Yeah, I don't know.
She's not gonna. And that's what makes it so sad.
I'd like to think she would.
No, that's a classic like old person thing. Like, you won't forget to visit, right? No, I won't. Like,
she does reiterate. She's like, no, I'll be there.
I don't think she's gonna. I don't think she is. She has a kid like in Tokyo and they live kind of outside Tokyo.
True.
And
maybe
I don't
her
think
and the
so.
Dad should have just gotten together. It's so funny. The dad has a line. He's like, I'm like 56. My life is winding down.
I know. It's so sad.
But again, yeah, people didn't live as long, 60, 70, 80 years, 70 years ago, this movie was made.
Now
people are getting their second wind at 57, but back then he was getting ready to to slow down. It's funny because in Tokyo Story, he's aged up. Like, he has gray hair in Tokyo Story and stuff, and is playing an older character. Yes. It's funny because the woman that plays his sister in this movie, you know, the aunt,
yeah,
she's his daughter in Tokyo Story.
Yes, you're right. You are right about that. I just wanted to mention one thing I learned. There is a made-up word by film theorists. It's a made-up Japanese word, a pseudo-Japanese word called shomengeki, which means, literally means common people drama. Mm-hmm. And Ozu wasn't the one to invent it, but he's like the greatest director in the category, obviously.
Yeah.
But that's his post-war stuff. All his post-war stuff is this common people drama.
In Britain, it was known as the kitchen sink drama.
I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
I think that's my favorite genre. Like,
that's one of mine too.
I teeter-totter between like what is really my favorite genre, and honestly, I think that might be it.
It's up there
like
for me.
Like Yee. And Brighter Summer Day.
Well, let's not talk about that.
Too soon.
A little too soon. We talked about transcendentalism and Paul Schrader's theory and Ozu in our Tokyo Story episode, so I feel like let's not reiterate that here. But if you do want to hear us talk about Paul Schrader and Ozu and all that stuff, go back and listen to our Tokyo Story episode if you have not already, because we cover a lot of that there. But let's talk about, again, I know this was brought up when we did Tokyo Story, but let's just talk about Ozu as the master of composition.
Yes.
Because, again, come on. Come on. Look at these frames. Are you kidding me?
I am kidding you.
Oh, you are? Okay, you're just joshing. Beautiful, beautiful. And again, it's subtle things like, there's a scene when Noriko is, I think it's when she goes into Tokyo, and she's walking on a sidewalk, mm-hmm. and Ozu frames a tree right in the middle of the frame. Uh-huh. Just one tree, a lone tree, and kind of obscures Noriko as she walks past.
Are you talking about that incredible transition between like when Hitori invites her to the concert, and then it's his seat, his empty seat next to him with his bag on it, and then her walking from behind? Is that what you're talking about?
No, she's on a sidewalk.
Oh, okay. Is it the one where she seems like she's walking into the camera, like the camera's in a corner?
She's walking away from the camera.
Oh, then I don't remember which one you're talking about.
But again, there's just so many.
There's so many, yes.
Like, he has such a sure, steady hand. And again, I think the first shot of this movie is like a train station.
Yes.
And then you get just like smokestacks, and you get a little bit of the neighborhood. In those beautiful atmospheric establishing shots.
They're incredible. And did you know that a lot of those are actually called pillow shots? So there's, do you know about pillow shots?
I do, yeah.
So, okay. So a pillow shot is, refers to those cutaways of seemingly random places, objects, or things. And this was a term coined by the critic Noel Birch. It's not exactly the same thing as some of the establishing shots. They are different. Sometimes they're not. Like, for example, the big one is the wave at the end, right? Mm-hmm. And that is what Paul Schrader called that wave the ultimate stasis. So yes, if you go back and listen to our transcendental blurb about all this, basically there's the disruption and then there's stasis, right? It returns to stasis, but it's more meaningful because you have just had this disruption. Mm-hmm. So the wave he called, well, no, the wave is one of them. Okay. Another one I really love is, do you remember when they're in Kyoto and there's the water fountain and a bunch of ladles?
How could I forget?
Is that your favorite shot?
No.
It's so good. So I love that one.
I've been to like shrines in Kyoto, and that's actually a station where you're supposed to like wash your hands or something. Yeah.
I love that. But Paul Schrader called the vase sequence like the ultimate stasis of all transcendental theory.
Yeah.
So this vase shot, it's when they are in...
It's actually vase. Oh. Just kidding.
They are in Kyoto and they have just had a lovely day and they finished like talking about the day. They're both sleeping on their beds, Noriko and her dad. And she asks him a question, but he's already asleep. Cuts to her smiling, her lovely, classic, iconic smile. Then it cuts to a shot of a vase. Then it cuts back to her. And she looks like she's about to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Paul Schrader called the ultimate stasis.
Mm. It's beautiful.
And there's all these theories about, like, I read there's on nofilmschool.com, there's an article about this whole vase scene. And the author of that said that he thought it was a symbol for her mom. Like, a lot of people interpret it.
Almost like an urn.
Yeah, her mom. It's a symbol for her mom. Another critic, I'm forgetting now which one, said that it is just a symbol of like Like, it's an unchanging thing, like a stasis, basically. Something unchanged, but then, like, the human is changing around it. So it's just beautiful. This, like, juxtaposition. Yeah. I think it's lovely. Do you have any, like, wild theories like that about what it's supposed to represent?
No, I always thought, I got the idea, like, it's urn-like. And, like, it's
her
mom. It's the mother, yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. Interesting. Because here's the thing. It's not her point of view. Mm-hmm. It's not, right. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be her point of view. She's looking up.
Right. Exactly.
So it's just a vase. Yeah. It could. What if that's not even in the room? Yeah. What if it's just an urn? Yeah. Here's what Schrader called. Here's his definition of a stasis: a form which can accept deep contradictory emotion and transform it into an expression of something unified, permanent, transcendent.
I love that.
I know.
Yeah.
I love that.
Here's the thing about Ozu. He makes it all look so easy.
I know.
Because it's all just sewn into the fabric of the movie.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's effortless, and nothing takes away from the experience. Nothing jolts you. It's just all like, it's beautifully sewn in.
I feel like I'm floating on air when I'm watching this movie.
Yeah. Any Ozu, really. It's just like, he's one of the, not that we need to tell you this, he is one of the all-time greats.
Yeah.
I can't even say it with a straight face, because of course he is. This is nothing new.
I love the transitions between scenes. I love the one where the dad and the aunt are, again, they're at a shrine or they're at a temple, and she's like running up the stairs. Mm-hmm. And that's like the transition into the next scene. Of course, my favorite one, I just mentioned it. It's when Hitori invites her to a concert and she's like, no, you're engaged. Like, I'm not going with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes alone. He doesn't even take his fiance, which is crazy.
Yeah, you get a little bit about him there.
Yeah, there's a seat next to him that was supposed to be for Noriko, and it's just his hat and his briefcase. And then it cuts to a shot of her walking home alone from the back, and it's beautiful.
I'm pretty sure he was crushing on her a little bit.
Definitely.
Also, it's hard not to, Noriko.
I know. So the actress who plays Noriko, Satsuko Hara, she retired from acting. Did you know this?
No.
Yeah, she retired from acting at a pretty young age. Like, I think in the 60s she retired. Or I think it was like, maybe it was like right after Ozu's death. She retired, and people didn't even know that she had died. When she died in the 90s, it wasn't released to the press until like 3 months later, because no one knew about it.
Oh, that's sad.
Is it though? Like, that's what she wanted. She wanted to just lead a reclusive life, and she left acting, and she never made public appearances. And yeah.
It's still sad because
it's a little, because she's a treasure. She's like the most beloved, I feel like.
Yeah. Of the Ozu stable of actors, yeah.
Let's talk about her face, because her face is the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's it.
Yeah. We talked about last episode, Lisa Yang in A Brighter Summer Day.
Yeah,
and kind
yeah.
of how her face was that film.
Just no, like, nowhere near as much as this.
Well, it should have been, right?
Maybe.
If it was a good movie.
It is a good movie.
Anyway, yeah. Her face is, again, it could just be her the whole time. It could be her in a room just like doing things, and you'd be like imagine a Jean Dielman, but with Setsuko Hara.
Smiling the entire time. The climax of the movie is that she frowns.
No,
she sneezes.
It's funny because I thought of Jean Dielman. I think in any movie that kind of conditions you to a certain thing that then pulls the rug out from you in like a very subtle way reminds me of
this
Jean Dielman.
This is transcendent. Yeah, like, it's also transcendent.
Yeah, exactly. But her just like not smiling anymore in this movie, of her like crying or frowning or something.
So
like,
I remember the first time I watched it, and when she's telling the dad's friend, like, oh, I find it really distasteful that you're remarried, filthy even, and she's smiling. I'm like, this bitch is crazy.
I almost thought she was kind of flirting with him there.
I know she's trying to be funny, I guess, but it caught me off guard the first time I watched it. I'm like, is she serious right now?
Well, it's funny because he is almost offended, but then she keeps going with it, and then he laughs
filthy.
It off.
Yeah. And like, she's smiling from ear to ear.
Filthy is the word that sets him off, and then he starts
it
laughing.
Just works. Yeah. And then when
she could give you the worst news or call
and
you
she's smiling.
With the worst names, and you'd be like, yeah, fine.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely. When she is having that like little picnic with the dad's assistant, and we just cut into the middle of their conversation, and she's like, he goes like, oh, like, I don't think you're the jealous type. And she's smiling big, and she's like, no, really, I am. Like, And she's like so pretty and innocent, but she's telling you that she's the jealous type and you're not taking her seriously until you realize when the dad says he's getting married and how hurt she is and how jealous she actually is.
Yeah.
But it's all that smile. That smile is like deceptive and mysterious, but also super warm and comforting and makes her just this like, I don't know, this like goddess of like innocence and purity.
Well, let's talk about, so in the Noriko trilogy, she plays different characters. They're all
different
named
Norikos.
But they're different, like it's not like the Noriko from this goes on to do Tokyo Story.
No, no, that's what I'm saying.
But in Tokyo, because I have not seen Early Summer. But
no, I really wanted to watch it before this episode.
In the last episode, you said you were going to watch it. Guess what?
I didn't
have
time, Greg. You
have failed our listeners.
I didn't have time.
So it's interesting that also in Tokyo Story, I wonder if in real life she just smiled all the time, because Tokyo Story is the same thing. She smiles through most of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if it's like, again, there's kind of people who experience like a really dark period of their lives and kind of like come out of it, tend to be like, I don't know if you, do you know the actor Richard E. Grant?
Yeah.
So he was like famously full of anxiety and depression for like years. And then he went to some therapist that like really helped him. And now he's like bouncing off the walls and like all of his Instagram stories, he's like smiling and laughing and he has this huge smile on his face. And it's one of those people, this is like a common thing, like when you go through a really dark period of your life, you come out and you're just like, you can be, if you, I guess, search deep enough, you become this like really just overflowing with happiness person. And I almost wonder if her war period was just so dark that she's now this like constantly smiling person. I don't know.
That's a really sweet theory.
I don't know.
It makes sense.
Yeah. But then again, same thing in Tokyo Story. Maybe Setsuko Hara just had a permanent smile on her face.
I'd love to like my friend learn more about that. I know.
Yeah.
I also love when he's like, he's really trying to like convince her to come to the concert. And she's just, again, her face has not changed. Yeah. It is just smiling. And she goes, no, I'm still not going.
Yeah.
And she's smiling. Yeah. And I'm like, but then now let's talk about when she's not smiling. So when she's crying, the first time she cries is when she's talking to the aunt and she's telling her, you know, you should really get married. And I love how it's like, she's like clearly crying, but it's so low key. I love that moment. Yeah. I love anytime she cries. And I know that's sad because she's smiling throughout the whole movie and I want her to be happy, but that's the point. It's like, okay, she's smiling the whole movie. So every time that she's not, it's so important and moving.
Yeah.
So that one I love. Oh my God. When she wipes her eyes, when she goes to her friend's house and she's waiting for her friend to come in and her friend comes in and she like wipes her eyes really quick.
Mm-hmm. Because there's this certain facade that she's created too.
That she's always smiling.
And she always has everything together. And
okay. And let's not even talk about her wedding day, because that one freaking kills me.
Yeah.
That kills me. He looks at her, he says, be happy, be a good wife. And her, like, you just see her face turn and like she's trying to smile and she can't. And it's, ugh.
How about when they're at that no performance and she
looks
over and sees
she's
the woman. She's
looking at the woman that's supposedly going to marry her dad.
And it's the way she just, again, stares, she's smiling.
Yeah,
and then it just like
it turns slowly and it's like, ugh.
Yeah. God.
It's genius. And then you have dad who keeps his cool the entire time, except the exact last millisecond of the movie.
What a great choice.
Like, incredible. Incredible. And at first you want to like, you want to hit him because he's like, he's being so casual and like, you get annoyed of him, but that's the point.
I don't know. I didn't get annoyed.
Okay, but he's being too cool. Like, he's saying, like, I'm going to get married. You need to get out of the house. Like,
it's kind of a Japanese thing, too. And it's a cultural thing.
Well, he's just okay, how about on her wedding day when the aunt turns to him and says, like, you want to say something to her? He goes, no, I have nothing to say. Like, don't you want to hit him in that moment?
Right.
You just shake him.
He's from the old world, like, you know.
Okay, but the aunt is also, and she's telling him, like, you know, you should say something to her. And he doesn't say anything. And my heart breaks
like,
until you realize that he's sad.
Well, see, I know people like this who just don't know how to express their feelings.
I mean, yes, and you know that the whole time, but I'm just saying, like, yeah, you want to grab him and shake him and be like, come on.
Sure,
like, the end.
The end.
Apple.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
How can you even talk about that?
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Just again, all he needs, Ozu, he's so he only gives the scene what it needs, mm-hmm. and nothing more. And the fact that all we need from him is for him to bow his, to put his head down while he's sitting there, because he doesn't start to cry. He just bows his head, right?
You know, his face looks like he's about to cry.
His head
for
drops,
a second.
Yeah.
For a second, it looks like he's about to, and then his head just drops.
Yeah. That is like beautifully understated. And again, it's just what you need. It's just what you need. The fact that this film is so powerful that when you just see someone's head drop, like, says the whole thing.
I'm about to cry.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah. I love the bike imagery in this movie, too. There's a lot of...
It's lovely.
There's the two bikes.
The two bikes.
Yeah. Side by side.
Yeah.
It's a lot of good stuff like that. It's so devastating at the end. It's right before she gets married and they're in Kyoto. And the dad says to her, he's like, why didn't we go more places? Like, we should have gone on more trips together. And it's that kind of like end of the line type talk of like, well, this is like our
now
last thing together.
Your
You're going to go with your husband. And hey, listen, I'm sorry. We didn't go more places. Like, we should have. And it's like those last minute regrets that are like really heartbreaking.
Really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I'm trying to plan a last Disneyland trip with my sister before she gets married. Like a family, all five of us going.
See, it's a different story because you're still going to see your sister after she gets married.
That's the thing. Is Noriko moving far?
I don't... Well, wait. He lives in Tokyo.
Yeah, but they only live like outside of Tokyo.
That's true. They'll still see him. But he does tell Noriko, he's like, "This, I'm not going to be in your life anymore," or something. Aww. But I'm sure they'll still see him. I think he just means that there's going to be a new man in your life. It's not going to be me. Also, we never see the fiance in
this
movie.
We never see him, which I love.
Which is a very cool choice.
I love it.
It's just like in Tokyo Story, right? I'm pretty sure...
Who do we not see?
There's a wedding in Tokyo Story that we just like don't see, or there's a funeral. No, we see the funeral.
We see the funeral.
Ozu is famous for just like, oh, there's this big event that's supposed to happen, and then he just cuts around it.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, wait, what? But it works.
Did you want to see the wedding in this movie?
No,
you wanted
to
see her get married?
I
think
it
was perfect that it's like right before and right after.
And we never see the fiance.
I really like that, actually.
Yeah.
Because they're hyping him up like he looks like Gary Cooper, and then you
the
just like never see him.
Like, she's like, oh, he looks like Gary Cooper. Oh, just the bottom half of his face.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines is he tells her when they're in Kyoto, now you have to give all the love you've given me to her husband. I forgot what his name is.
Yeah. I know.
It's so sad.
Yeah.
And I love how she's so simple about it. She's like, I just want to stay how we are. Like, why can't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
Yeah.
Can we do sight and sound?
Let's do sight and sound. What was your favorite sight?
My favorite sight is after they go to that play. And she's really sad because she spent the whole play looking at the woman that's going to marry her dad. And he goes like, where are you going? And she's like, I have to go or
this
something.
I have the same one. Go ahead.
Okay, so it's like when she's walking ahead of him, it's kind of his point of view. It's tracking. There's the whole sequence. I love it all. I love when you see both of them. I love when it's his point of view of her walking ahead of him. I love it all.
Well, here's what I love about it, too. She takes this like rocky path. Like
they're
going in the same direction, but she specifically walks away from him onto this rocky path and he's like on the pavement.
Yes.
And it's just a perfect symbolic thing.
Same one?
Yep. I have the exact same
sight. So good.
Because again, that's the movie. That's the movie. Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yep.
What's your favorite sound then?
So yeah, mine is when it's like just after the wedding, I think. It's either right before or right.
No,
I think
it's
right
before.
After.
It's when they're in Kyoto.
Oh, that's right, because the wedding doesn't happen in Kyoto. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're in Kyoto, and him and his friend are sitting there, the father.
It's so beautiful.
And they look out on that Zen garden, and there's just the score. Again, Ozu's scores are very kind of like minimal, but like really heartbreaking.
I know.
And that was almost a combination of favorite sight and sound. But,
yeah, it is great.
So yeah, this is what it sounds like.
Zen. It's sitting in meditation. Like, that is it.
Yeah. Like the rest of the movie, it's quietly devastating.
Yeah.
What about you? What's your favorite sound?
Mine is the, I think it's like the only time like diegetic and non-diegetic sound is combined. Uh-huh. And it's when they're in Kyoto and it's like the sound of children playing, chanting going on, and also music.
Mm-hmm.
I'll play it for you. And then the music just fades out.
Yeah.
Like so seamlessly. And you still hear the chanting because that's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah, it is.
And that shot, and you don't, just looks beautiful too.
I know.
Again, like I said about Tokyo Story, you can take almost any frame from this movie and hang it on a wall.
I agree.
And it would be amazing.
Especially Balboa Coffee and Tea.
Yeah. Yeah, his signs. As the way he uses signs is a transitional thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of his films, the signage of, like, cafes and bars and restaurants is so prominent.
Yeah.
And I love the way he does all that.
I love it, too. What does Pauline say?
So, this is normally where we do Pauline Says, the segment where we read Pauline Kael's review of the film, but I could not find this one. Obviously, the film came out in 49. It was released in the U.S. in 72.
Mm-hmm.
But could not find, I don't think Pauline had anything to say about Late Spring.
Really
so.
Strange.
Yeah.
Sad. Missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Should we instead listen to what the good people of Letterboxd have to say?
Let's do it.
Okay. A part of me hates puns. A part of me likes them.
Yeah.
2 stars. Waited too late to spring into action.
That's how we felt about Brighter Summer Day.
Yeah.
Someone gave it 5 stars and said, Ozu's greatest statement on how he prefers Coke to Pepsi.
I love that one. I saw that. 1.5 stars. So boring, it makes Tokyo Story look like a Michael Bay film.
2 stars. My first Ozu movie. I sadly found it very boring, and I swear there isn't a frame of this movie where an actor isn't smiling. The intense lighting and the static shots were powerful, but they weren't enough to make me enjoy the company of these characters.
Mm. 5 stars. Happy birthday, Setsuko Hara. I am in pain.
4.5. Honestly, I never would have known what it takes to nurture a story so pure and delicate at its core until I saw this masterpiece. It's like holding a newborn child in your arms.
Aww.
You're bound to shed tears just by looking at the irreparable innocence and sensibility of it.
I love that. Good job.
They say at the end, and last but not least, all you need is a tranquil smile of Setsuko Hara to brighten your day.
I really like that one. Last one, 3.5 stars. Heterosexuality is an evil social institution. Only a gay person can make a movie that so viciously condemns it like this.
I saw that.
Referring, of course, to the rumors that Ozu was gay, closeted gay. But there's also some rumors that him and Setsuko Hara were having an affair. Mm-hmm. And that's why she retired after he passed away.
Yeah.
Don't know.
We may never know.
Yeah. Well, that was the delightful Late Spring. Next week, we are going to do a personal print. And I'm really excited because it is my personal print.
Yeah.
And it may or may not involve music.
Hmm. Big surprise. We do like to keep the personal prints kind of a secret. It's like the one mm-hmm. thing we have a little fun mm-hmm. with, you know, teasing them out.
Mm-hmm.
If you do follow us at the Arroyo Film Club Instagram page, we do give a little hint a couple days before. It's a very cryptic image from the film. We try to usually go, you know, like sort of obscure, but not so obscure. We're like, you'd be like, what the fuck?
It's going to be
that?
Really hard for this movie.
Yes. Well,
I just realized.
I think, well, you'd be surprised.
Okay. I trust you.
So, yeah, come back next week because we're doing a personal print and it's one of Jackie's favorites.
It's going to be freaking awesome.
Until then, I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
Have a great week. This has been an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club. Seen and Heard is Jacqueline Pistagian and Greg Kleinschmidt. Theme music by Andrew Cox. You can find us at seenandheardpod.com.